The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, America is experiencing renewed efforts to ban books, pass so-called parents' rights legislation, and vilify teachers' unions. I'll speak with the authors of The Education Wars, a citizen's guide and defense manual about who and what is putting schools at the center of the culture war. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. In big cities and small towns, the U.S. culture war has invaded the public school system. A new book unpacks who and what is behind the culture war in schools and how everyday people can inform themselves on what might be happening in their own community. Published by The New Press, The Education Wars, a citizen's guide and defense manual, explores what's at play, what's at stake, and how people can reclaim education as a public good. To learn more, I spoke with authors Jennifer Berkshire and Jack Schneider.
When culture war stuff really erupted in 2020, I think a lot of people were really taken off guard by it. And what we've seen over the last few years is that the potency of those issues at the level of elections has turned out not to be as powerful as we thought, that other than the election of Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, there really aren't a lot of examples of Republican candidates luring disaffected suburban voters back into the Republican fold by, you know, ginning up culture war issues. And that, if you think back to the Youngkin election, that was really the bold claim that was being made, that Republicans were now the party of education and parents' rights. Well, you fast forward to today, and, you know, you kind of have to wonder, well, why do they keep running on this stuff if they're just losing elections, right? We know that candidates who are allied with Moms for Liberty and groups that are like that are losing about three quarters of the time. So you think, well, this is kind of weird, right? But the reality is that these issues are profoundly animating for the Republican base, for older, very conservative voters. And if you go to a Trump rally, these are the issues that drive the base wild. Anytime he talks about banning critical race theory, cutting off federal funding, eliminating the Department of Education. And so you have this set of issues that are, you know, really resonate with the base, but not with less extreme voters. And then as Jack and I looked around, what we saw was that the culture war flames were really being fanned in order to justify an agenda of school privatization. And that's another reason why we see culture war playing out the way that it is right now, that you have deep-pocketed donors who are really enthusiastic about school privatization, about school vouchers in particular. They see this as their moment. And the more they can get people fighting about the schools or give the appearance that all we do is fight over the schools, the more they've created an opening for extreme solutions that otherwise voters and constituents might not go along with.
Thanks, Jennifer. And Jack, what can you tell me about school vouchers? And why have they become so popular as a talking point and also put into use in some states in recent years? What about them is so appealing?
It's a really good question. And I think the first thing to say in response is that they actually aren't that appealing if the American people really know what they stand to lose when a school voucher is proposed. So we can go back to the presidency of Ronald Reagan to find the first effort to introduce school vouchers through, you know, in this case, it was the federal government, but any sort of large-scale state effort. And they were resoundingly unpopular then. And every time vouchers have come up for a public vote since then, they have lost, often resoundingly so. So then the question is, well, why now are we seeing school voucher bills introduced basically in every state where there's a conservative majority in the state legislature? And that's because Support for vouchers has essentially become a litmus test in the Republican Party, largely driven by, as Jennifer was just discussing, this is being driven by the base of the Republican Party and by a core set of policy elites that for several decades has bided its time and built power and built institutions and waited for a moment when they could actually drive through this kind of legislation. And it just so happens that the culture warring that emerged out of the Trump presidency and continued after Biden was elected, that culture warring proved really useful for voucher supporters. Again, as Jennifer was saying, that if you can convince the American people that actually the public schools have gone off the rails and that things have changed over the past generation, that people who attended the public schools themselves, and that's 90% of Americans who got an education in this country, experienced a different kind of school than students today are experiencing. If you can convince them of that, if you can convince them that schools are now places of indoctrination and brainwashing, of political ideology run rampant, then they may be more open to the idea that the project of public education is no longer worth pursuing. And maybe this idea of sending your child to a private school by using a voucher where you can then really control the kinds of things your child is taught, maybe that will be more popular with people. And so it's really been a kind of coming together, a perfect storm of the culture war that emerged in the wake of Trump's presidency, decades-long effort to drive vouchers forward, and then a real commitment by leaders in the Republican Party to the idea right now.
Why do you think that public school teachers and public school teachers' unions have become the boogeyman, as you put it in the book? Why are public school teachers being demonized by particularly strongly one political party?
Well, there's a pretty simple answer to that, and that is that over the past few decades, they have become more and more identified with the Democratic Party. And so if you read Betsy DeVos's most recent book, and I did actually read it, she recounts with great glee how one of the first political projects they undertook in Michigan was to knock out union-supporting Republicans, right? That supporting teachers used to be a bipartisan cause. And the more they've become identified with a particular party, the easier it is to justify weakening them. And so if you look at states, for example, that have had Republican trifectas for years now, one of their major projects is always to try to weaken the teachers' union. And that the reasoning for that is really political. It has very little to do with the sorts of things we're used to hearing about school quality, for example. They associate teachers' unions with performing the role of the foot soldiers for the Democratic Party, right? They raise money, they run candidates, they take people to the polls. And the more you can make it hard for them to do that or make it illegal for them to do that, the more you weaken the Democratic Party. And we've seen all sorts of evidence about how that works. So for example, when Michigan became a right-to-work state in 2014, we could measure the impact of this in down ballot elections, that the candidates who are left to run are wealthier and turnout drops because you don't have that sort of volunteer base. And so I think that over time, Democrats have come to understand that it was a mistake on their part to join forces with Republicans in making weakening teachers' unions a bipartisan cause. And today we're seeing the politics flip a little bit because unions are so much more popular across the board, especially with young people, and that extends to teachers' unions.
Now, isn't it an easy argument to say, perhaps, well, the teachers' unions are pushing for higher salaries for teachers, and that leads to higher school property taxes, and that's why it may be easy to grab onto for a party that prefers smaller government and lower taxes?
So that's absolutely true. But the real reason why these conservative state lawmakers and policy elites don't like teachers' unions really doesn't have much to do with school funding. It's all of the other things that teacher unions lobby for. It's the expanded safety nets. And so if you compare states across the country where unions are strong against states where unions are weak or non-existent, you will find that by every single measure, kids fare better in the states where unions are stronger. And that's because those unions lobby for things like a higher minimum wage. Jack and I are in Massachusetts, where we now have a millionaire's tax. It took years of multiple rounds on the ballot. The teachers' union was the driving force there. And that's exactly the sort of thing that your conservative lawmakers in a state where unions are weak, they look at that in horror.
Now, where does religion come into the equation? Because we're seeing that increasingly, I think now, just because it's campaign season, with slogans and political flags. But where does religion and prayer in schools enter the equation when it comes to the culture war?
Support for private school vouchers has largely come from two separate camps over time. One of them was a kind of ideologically committed camp of Milton Friedman acolytes. So these are people who believe wholeheartedly in free markets and who really believe that we should be running education the way that we run most other goods in this society, through the free market, rather than through democratic politics. And then there's this other camp, which is a camp made up mostly of evangelical Christians who are relatively outraged that they can't educate their children in the faith that they strongly believe in without having to pay for it themselves. Now, there's a long history of why we don't publicly fund religious education in this country. And there are other countries where people do it. And those who would like to see a publicly funded Christian education happening in this country will often point to those other countries as examples of what they would like to see. And what we have really witnessed over the past 5 to 10 years is a convergence of these two groups. And there's a third group there that really makes a kind of set of strange bedfellows. And these are the folks who are really engaged in the culture war. And the way that this has been working is that the culture warriors have really created space for the religiously convicted and for those committed to free markets to make their pitches for why Americans, and particularly Republican families, should pull their children out of the public schools and enroll them in private schools. And the religiously convicted have been making the case that the public schools have gone off the rails, so they have used the culture war as a way of making a case against the public schools, and have then made a case that if what you would prefer is a more traditional education and one that is rooted in Christian values to boot, then you should be thrilled about a voucher bill that would enable you to use taxpayer dollars to pursue a private school education. And we should remember that the vast majority of private schools are religious. Now, those of us who are a little bit uncomfortable with publicly funding religious education should know that even though there will be a lot of rhetoric around the advantages of a private school education and that the religious component will often be played down to public audiences, that if we're talking about shifting students out of the public system and into the private system, we are talking mostly about shifting students out of public schools that are non-sectarian and into religious schools. And I'll just add one more thing here, which is that in every state where we have seen vouchers enacted, the first users of those vouchers are families that have never sent their children to public schools. And so right now, what we're seeing is a massive handout to families, most of them middle-class families, who already send their children to religious schools and are essentially just getting a rebate from the public treasury for the private school tuition that they had previously been paying.
So I wanted to turn to book banning efforts. Right now, it's noted that book banning is, we're kind of experiencing a trend right now where Jennifer and Jack, where you're located in Massachusetts, I understand that There's been legislation in recent years to protect against book bans in public libraries and at schools. But why has this campaign for restricting and removing books from school libraries, why is that picking up steam? Does it all dovetail together when we talk about school vouchers, when we talk about parents' rights? Is it all generally connected and supported by the same people?
There's a really telling example from Florida, and this was at a time when communities there were warring over a mask requirement. And there was a school district in Orange County, Florida, where really the minute the governor banned school districts from enforcing mask mandates, protesters at the school board meeting immediately pivoted to book banning. And it shows you that the content of the complaints is constantly shifting. But one of the ones that really has gained traction, especially among parents and other people who don't have kids in these school districts, are these demands to pull books off of shelves. And so we've seen a tremendous push to do this. And I think what's really interesting is how unpopular these efforts are, that as divided as we are, nothing really brings Americans together across party lines like their opposition to book banning. And again, we see evidence of this in Florida, where, you know, the governor has ended up being kind of embarrassed. They have very lax requirements there. And so anyone can call for the removal of a book. You don't have to live in the school district. You don't have to have kids in the school district. And so this stuff started to generate a lot of really embarrassing headlines, right? That like somebody wants to pull the Bible off the shelf. And so Governor DeSantis has had to walk that back. We're seeing similar things play out across the country. But as long as you have that tremendous energy on the base that, you know, is absolutely convinced that there's indoctrination happening and is going to go looking for it, you're going to continue to see objections being raised to particular books, and you're going to be seeing resistance to that too.
Say you have a local library board or a local school board, and they hear about the efforts to ban books, and they hear about these books that are controversial, whether it be books for young readers or graphic novels. Is there a growing sense among local officials that are saying, hey, I don't want to rock the boat. Let's just go along with it. We don't need to draw this attention to our small town.
There's definitely a chilling effect here. And one of the things that culture warriors on the right have learned is that if they remain on the offensive, that they win just by virtue of the fact that there is too much coming down the pike for folks to resist all of it. And ultimately, it becomes easier for schools and libraries to preempt any of those attacks by saying, let's not bring any of this stuff down on us. And this is really less about the push for private school vouchers. And in talking about book bans, we can see how there really is a kind of interest convergence between supporters of private school vouchers and supporters of a kind of conservative culture push in schools as well as in other places where you can reach young people, because not every effort to engage in the culture war is inherently connected to the private school voucher agenda. And we can look at somebody like Christopher Rufo as an example of somebody who is a supporter of private school vouchers, but who, for the most part, has more of a cultural agenda, who is more concerned with advancing conservative values, Christian values, white cultural values in schools. And to the degree that private school vouchers will advance that agenda, he's supportive of those. Whereas folks who are more interested in the free market ideology of private school vouchers and who don't believe that the state should have a role in a sector like education, they tend to see the culture war piece as just being conducive for the kinds of arguments that they're making. But again, one of the things that is really concerning to me and to Jennifer as observers here is the way that these two movements have really worked to reinforce each other.
I wanted to talk about engagement on the part of local communities. You point out the example of the Little Red School in New Hampshire, where a school budget was essentially halved. Could you tell me a little bit more about that story and what initially happened, and then how local community residents rallied to essentially save the school?
Yeah, that's one of our favorite stories. So this happened in a community in New Hampshire called Croydon. And New Hampshire, as some people may be aware of, is home to a bold libertarian movement called the Free State Project. And their goal was to recruit 10,000 libertarians to move to New Hampshire to really try to influence politics. And one of the ways that they've been very effective is that they have ended up on these very local boards, like school boards, like municipal oversight bodies. And that was the case in Croydon, that they had accumulated quite a bit of local power and influence. And when it came time to approve the school budget, one of their leaders initiated a motion from the floor to make a drastic cut to the school budget. And it was approved. There were very few people in the room that day. But the impact of that was that, number one, their elementary school, it's a K through five school called Little Red, that would no longer function as a traditional public school. Instead, it would be a micro school run by a for-profit vendor, and they would have a guide instead of a certified teacher. And that's just any adult over the age of 21. But because Croydon is so small, people send their kids to public schools in the area. And there was no longer going to be enough money for the community to reimburse those school districts. And so parents were going to have to shoulder a considerable portion of that by themselves. And so if you were somebody who had three kids, you were suddenly looking at having to come up with $20,000 to pay to send your kids to public schools. So the response to this was really pretty astonishing. And I think what we found so encouraging was that it brought together people across party lines. One of the strongest advocates for reversing the cuts had an enormous Trump banner on the side of her barn. And so they organized in a way that was really pretty impressive. And they gathered together and it was the largest single gathering in Croydon history. And I had the good fortune of being there that day when they voted to reverse this cut. And I think it really gave them the sense of, one, how much power they could have if they work together. But two, that if you sort of let your democratic responsibilities slide, it's only a matter of time before your institutions start to drift away from you.
Jennifer Berkshire and Jack Schneider are the authors of The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual. Jennifer and Jack, I wanted to take a look at the title of the book itself. Why do you call this book a defense manual?
We wrote a previous book together called A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, where our goal was really to alert people to the threat posed to public education by the privatization agenda, as well as what at the time was some emerging culture war in education. And one of the things that we heard from activists and public school supporters and families was that they really wanted some advice about what to do, and they actually wanted the book to be a little bit more basic in terms of bringing people into the conversation. And as we saw the culture wars really begin to catch fire across all 50 states, and as we saw voucher legislation introduced in about half of the states, we realized that probably it was the time to write that book that people had been asking us to write. And so we sought to write a really accessible book that would help people from all walks of life, and that includes all political persuasions, understand what's happening right now in the public education system. And we wanted to offer some practical advice about what they can do if they're concerned about what they're seeing right now.
And Jennifer, do you have any hope for how this book is used and picked up by readers moving forward?
Yes, I hope that after people read it, that they will then pass it along to someone else in their life who has questions about why there is so much fighting over the schools right now. And we are really hopeful that folks in red states will read it. Because one of the things that we're seeing happen right now is that those enormous school voucher programs that we've been talking about, those have been basically jammed through one state legislature after another. And so you have this very interesting situation where you have not just Democrats who are feeling disempowered and disenfranchised right now, but Republicans too. And we really see organizing around public education as an issue that could potentially be used to make the Republican Party less extreme. And we think that our little book, which is written for the most general audience we're capable of writing for, will be helpful in realizing that goal.
Yeah, I'll add one more thing to what Jennifer was just saying, which is that both of us are big believers in public education, not just because we believe in the principles that animate that system, right? That it's a system that is open to all, that advances the common good, but also because we see it as a bedrock of American democracy, which is also something that both of us are big supporters of and something that we have real concerns about. And we're not alone in fearing that Americans are beginning to ask questions about the utility of democracy. And our schools happen to be an institution that the vast majority of us still believe in. And before it's too late, we hope that people will recognize all of the ways that our schools can and do bring us together, and the ways that our schools can and do help us see the things that we share and the values that we have in common.
Jennifer Berkshire and Jack Schneider are the authors of The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual, published by The New Press. Jennifer and Jack, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us.
It was great to be here.
If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1762. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.